Anne came in, her hair all flattened on one side and all frowsy on the other. She was sausaged into one of Stella's old dressing gowns.
"I heard that, Sears James," she said in a voice like the wail of an ambulance. "You'll bully John even when he's dead."
"Millie, I meant no disrespect," Sears said. "Shouldn't you—"
"No! You won't get rid of me now. I won't give you coffee now and bow and scrape. I have something to say to you. John didn't commit suicide. Louis Benedict, you listen to. He didn't. He wouldn't have. John was murdered."
"Millie," Ricky began.
"Do you think I'm deaf? Do you think I don't know what's going on? John was killed. And do you know who killed him? Well, I do."
Footsteps. This time Stella's came hurrying down the stairs.
"I know who killed him. It was you. You Chowder Society. You killed him with your terrible stories. You made him sick. You and your Fenny Bates."
Her face twisted. Stella rushed in too late to stop Millie's final words.
"They ought to call you the Murder Society. They ought to call you Murder Incorporated."
7. So there they stood, Murder Incorporated, beneath a bright sky in late October. They felt grief, anger, despair, guilt. They had been talking of graves and corpses compulsively for a year, and now they were burying one of their own. The unexpected findings of the autopsy had puzzled and distressed them all. Sears had blown up, choosing to disbelieve. Ricky, too, had not at first believed that John could have been a dope addict. Evidence of massive, habitual, and long-standing introduction of narcotic substance. Then, a lot of fancy medical language. But the point was that the coroner had publicly defamed John Jaffrey. Sears's ranting had been of no use. The man would not change his story. Sears would not alter his opinion that in the course of one autopsy the man had changed from a skillful professional to an incompetent and dangerous fool. The coroner's findings had circulated through Milburn, and some citizens said they sided with Sears, and some accepted the autopsy's conclusions. But none came to the funeral. Even the Reverend Neil Wilkinson seemed embarrassed. The funeral of a suicide and drug addict. Well. The new girl, Anna, had been wonderful. She'd helped deal with Sears's rage, cushioning Mrs. Quast from the worst effects of it. She'd been as marvelous with Millie Sheehan as Stella had. And she'd transformed the office. She had forced Ricky to realize that Hawthorne James had plenty of work if Hawthorne and James wanted to do it. Even during the terrible period of arranging John's funeral, even on the day he took a suit from John's closet and bought a coffin, he and Sears found themselves responding to more letters and answering more phone calls than they had for weeks. They had been drifting toward retirement, sending clients elsewhere as if automatically, and Anna Mostyn seemed to have brought them back to life. She had mentioned her aunt only once, and in the most harmless way. She had asked them what she was like. Sears had come close to blushing and muttered, "Almost as pretty as you, but not as fierce." And she had been staunchly on Sears's side in the matter of the autopsy. Even coroners make mistakes, she had pointed out with placid, undeniable common sense. Ricky was not so sure. He was not even sure it mattered. John had functioned perfectly well as a doctor. His own body had weakened, but he had remained competent at curing other bodies. Surely a massive, habitual, etc. drug habit would account for the physical decline John had exhibited. A daily insulin injection, would have got John used to needles. He found that if John Jaffrey had been an addict, it did not much affect what he thought of him. And this, it made the suicide explicable. No empty-eyed, barefooted Fenny Bate, no Murder Incorporated, no mere stories had killed him. The drug had eaten into his brain as it had eaten into his body. Or he could not take it any more, the shame of addiction, or something. Sometimes it was convincing. In the meantime, his nose ran and his chest tickled. He wanted to sit down. He wanted to be warm. Millie Sheehan was gripping Stella as if the two of them were battered by a hurricane, now and then using one hand to pluck another tissue from the box, wipe her eyes, and drop the tissue on the ground. Ricky took a damp tissue from his own coat pocket, discreetly wiped his nose, and returned it to his pocket. All of them heard the car coming up the hill to the cemetery. From the Journals of Don Wanderley. 8. It seems I am an honorary member of the Chowder Society. It's all very odd. In fact, just the peculiarity of it all is a shade unsettling. Maybe the oddest part of my being here is that my uncle's friends almost seem to fear that they are caught in some kind of real-life horror story, a story like The Night Watcher. It was because of The Night Watcher that they wrote me. They saw me as some sort of steel-plated professional, an expert in the supernatural. They saw me as a Van Helsing. My original impressions were correct. They all do feel a distinct foreboding. I suppose you could say they're on the verge of being scared of their own shadows. My role is to investigate, of all things. And what they haven't told me directly, but have implied, is that I'm supposed to say, "Nothing to worry about, boys. There's a rational, reasonable explanation for everything." But of that I have little doubt. They want me to be able to write, too. They're very firm about that. Sears James said, "We didn't ask you here so that we could interrupt your career." So they want me to give about half of my day to Dr. Rabbitfoot and the other half to them. There's the feeling, definitely, that part of what they want is just someone to talk to. They've been talking to themselves for too long. Not long after the secretary, Anna Mostyn, left, the dead man's housekeeper said that she wanted to lie down, and Stella Hawthorne took her upstairs. When she came back down, Mrs. Hawthorne gave us all large glasses of whiskey. In Millburn High Society, which I guess this is, you drink whiskey English style, neat. We had a painful, halting conversation. Stella Hawthorne said, "I hope you knock some sense into these characters' heads," which mystified me. They hadn't yet explained the real reason why they asked me to come. I nodded, and Lewis said, "We have to talk about it." That silenced them again. "We want to talk about your book, too," Lewis said. "Fine," I said. More silence. "I might as well feed you three owls," Stella Hawthorne said. "Mr. Wanderley, will you please give me a hand?" I followed her into the kitchen, expecting to be handed plates or cutlery. What I did not expect was for the elegant Mrs. Hawthorne to whirl around, slam the door behind her, and say, "Didn't those three old idiots in there say why they wanted you to come here?" "I guess they fudged a little," I said. "Well, you better be good, Mr. Wanderley," she said, "because you're going to have to be Freud to deal with those three. I want you to know that I don't approve of your being here at all. I think people should solve their problems by themselves." They implied they just wanted to talk to me about my uncle," I said. Even with her gray hair, I thought she could be no older than about 46 or 47, and she looked as beautiful and stern as a ship's figurehead.
"Your uncle? Well, maybe they do. They'd never deign to tell me."
And I understood part of the reason for her fury.
"How well did you know your uncle, Mr. Wanderley?"
I asked her to use my first name. "Not very well. After I went to college and moved to California, I didn't see him more than once every couple of years. I hadn't seen him at all for several years before his death."
"But he left you his house. Doesn't it strike you as a little bit funny that those three characters out there didn't suggest you stay there?"
Before I could reply, she went on.
"Well, even if it doesn't, it does me. And not only funny, but pathetic. They're afraid to go into Edward's house. They just all came to a kind of silent agreement. They've never entered that house. They're superstitious, that's why."
I thought I felt... Well, when I came to the funeral, I thought I saw... I stammered, not sure of how far I could go with her.
"Bully for you," she said.
"Maybe you're not as big a blockhead as they are. But I tell you this, Don Wanderley, if you make them any worse than they are already, you'll have me to answer to." She put her hands on her hips, her eyes sizzling, and then she exhaled. Her eyes changed. She gave me a tight, pained smile and said, "We'd better get busy, or I suppose they'll start to gossip about you." She opened the refrigerator and pulled out a platter holding a roast the size of a young pig.
"Cold roast beef all right for you? The carving things are in the drawer to your right. Start cutting."
Only after Stella rather abruptly left the house for what she called an appointment, after the strange scene in the kitchen, I had a passing notion of its character, and the momentary expression of utter misery which crossed Ricky Hawthorne's face confirmed it, did the three men open up to me. Bad choice of words. They did not open up at all, at least not until much later. But after Stella Hawthorne had driven off, the three old men began to show me why they had asked me to come to Millburn. It began like a job interview.
"Well, here you are at last, Mr. Wanderley," said Sears James, pouring more cognac into his glass and removing a fat cigar case from the inside pocket of his jacket.
"Cigar? I can vouch for their merit."
"No, thanks," I said. "And please call me Don."
"Very well. I have not welcomed you properly, Don, but I will do so now. We were all great friends of your Uncle Edward's. I am, and I speak for my two friends as well, very grateful that you have come across the country to join us. We think that you can help us."
"Does this have to do with my uncle's death?"
"In part. We want you to work for us."
Then he asked me if we could talk about the Night Watcher.
"Of course. It was a novel, therefore in large part an invention. But was this invention based on an actual case? We assume you did research for the book, but what we want to know is whether in the course of your research you discovered any corroborating evidence for the ideas in your book, or perhaps your research was inspired by some inexplicable occurrence in your own life."
I could almost feel their tension on my fingertips, and perhaps they could feel mine on theirs. They knew nothing about David's death, but they had asked me to expose the central mystery of both the Night Watcher and my life.
"The invention, as you put it, was based on an actual case," I said, and the tension broke. "Could you describe that to us?"
"No," I said.
It's not clear enough to me. Also, it's too personal. I'm sorry, but I can't go into it.
We can respect that, Sears James said. You seem nervous.
I am, I admitted, and laughed.
The situation in the Night Watcher was based on a real situation that you knew about?
Asked Ricky Hawthorne, as if he hadn't been paying attention or could not believe what he had just heard.
That's right.
And you know of other similar cases?
No.
But you do not reject the supernatural out of hand, Sears said.
I don't know if I do or not, I said, like most people.
Louis Benedict sat up straight and stared at me.
But you just said...
No, he didn't, Ricky Hawthorne put in. He just said his book was based on a real event. Not that it recounted the event exactly. Is that right, Don?
More or less.
But what about your research? Asked Louis.
I didn't actually do much, I said.
Hawthorne sighed, glanced at Sears with what looked like irony. I told you so.
I think you can help us anyway, Sears said, as if he were contradicting a voiced opinion. Your skepticism will do us good.
Maybe, Hawthorne muttered.
I was still feeling that they had blundered into my most private space.
What does all this have to do with my uncle's heart attack? I asked. There was a lot of self-defense in the question, but it was the right question to ask. It all came out. James had decided to tell me everything.
And we've been having unthinkable nights. I know that John did too. It is not exaggerating to say that we fear for our reason. Would either of you dispute that?
Hawthorne and Louis Benedict looked as though they were remembering things they'd rather not and shook their heads.
So we want your expert help, and as much time as you can reasonably give us, Sears concluded. John's apparent suicide has shaken us all very deeply. Even if he was a drug addict, which I dispute, I do not think he was a potential suicide.
What was he wearing? I asked. It was just a stray thought.
Wearing? I don't recall. Ricky, did you look at his clothing?
Hawthorne nodded.
I had to throw it out. It was the most astounding assortment of things. His evening jacket, a pajama shirt, the trousers to another suit, no socks.
That's what John put on when he got up the morning he died? Louis asked, astonished.
Why didn't you tell us before? At first I was shocked by it, and then I forgot. Too much was happening.
But he was usually such a fastidious man, Louis said. Damn it! If John jumbled his clothes up like that, his mind must have been jumbled too.
Precisely, Sears said, and smiled at me.
Don, that was a perceptive question. None of us thought of it.
I could see him beginning to snatch up all the available rationalizations.
It doesn't simplify things to point out that his mind was jumbled, I pointed out. In the case I had in mind when I did my book, a man killed himself, and I'm damn sure his mind was shaken, but I never found out what really happened to him.
You're talking about your brother, aren't you? Asked Ricky Hawthorne cleverly.
Naturally. So they all knew, after all. My uncle had told them about David.
And that was the case you alluded to?
I nodded.
Uh-oh, Louis said.
I said, I just turned it into a ghost story. I don't know what really happened. For a moment, all three of them looked embarrassed.
Well, Sears James said, Even if you are not accustomed to doing research, I am sure that you're capable of it.
Ricky Hawthorne leaned back into his eccentric couch. His bow tie was still immaculate, but his nose was red and his eyes bleary. He looked small and lost in the midst of his giant furniture.
It will obviously make my two friends happier if you stay with us for a while, Mr. Wanderley.
Don.
Don, then. Since you seem prepared to do that, and since I am exhausted, I suggest we all say good night. You'll spend the night at Lewis's.
Lewis Benedict said,
That's fine, and stood up. I have one question, I said. Are you asking me to think about the supernatural, or whatever you want to call it, because that absolves you from thinking about it? Perceptive, but inaccurate, Sears James said, looking at me with his rifle-shot's blue eyes. We think about it all the time.
That reminds me, Lewis said. Are you going to stop the Chowder Society meetings? Does anyone think we should?
No,
Ricky said, with an odd defiance.
For heaven's sake, let's not. For our sakes, let's continue to meet. Don will be included.
So, here I am. Each of the three men, my uncle's friends, seemed admirable in his own way. But are they losing their minds? I can't even be sure they have told me everything. They are frightened, and two of them have died. And I wrote earlier in this journal that Milburn feels like the sort of town where Dr. Rabbitfoot would go to work. I can feel reality slithering away from me. If I start to imagine that one of my own books is happening around me. The trouble is, I could almost start to imagine that. Those two suicides, David's and Dr. Jaffrey's, that's the problem, the simple coincidence. And the Chowder Society shows no signs of recognizing that this coincidence is the main reason I'm interested in their problem. What am I involved in here? A ghost story? Or something worse, something not just a story? The three old men have only the sketchiest knowledge of the events of 2 years ago, and they can't possibly know that they've asked me to enter the strangest part of my life again, to roll myself back through the calendar to the worst, most destructive days, or to roll myself up again in the pages of a book which was my attempt to reconcile myself with them. But can there really be any connection, even if it is just the connection of one ghost story leading to another, as it did with the Chowder Society? And can there truly be any factual connection between the Night Watcher and what happened to my brother?
Chapter 2 Alma. Everything that has beauty has a body, and is a body. Everything that has being in the flesh. And dreams are only drawn from the bodies that are. Bodiless God, D.H. Lawrence. From the Journals of Don Wanderley. 1. There is only one way to answer that question. I have to spend a little time over the next week or two in writing out in some detail the facts as I remember them about myself and David and Alma Mobley. When I fictionalized them in the book, I inevitably sensationalized them, and doing so falsified my own memories. If I were satisfied with that, I would never have considered writing the Dr. Rabbitfoot novel. He's no more than Alma in blackface, Alma with horns, tail, and a soundtrack. Just as Rachel Varney in The Night Watcher was no more than Alma in fancy dress. Alma was far stranger than Rachel. What I want to do now is not invent fictional situations and fictional peculiarities, but look at the peculiarities that existed. In the Night Watcher, everything was solved. Everything came out even. In life, nothing came out even, and nothing was solved. I met Alma not as Saul Malkin met Rachel Varney in a Paris dining room, but in surroundings utterly banal. It was at Berkeley, where good notices for my first book had obtained me a year's teaching job. The post was a coup for a first book writer, and I took it seriously. I taught one section of creative writing and two sections of an undergraduate course in American literature. It was the second of these that caused most of my work. I had to do so much reading of work which I didn't know well, and so much theme grading that I had little time to write. And if I had barely read Howells or Cooper, I had never looked at the criticism about them, which the structure of the course demanded I know. I found myself falling into a routine of teaching my courses, taking the creative writing work home to read before I ate dinner at a bar or cafe, and then spending my evenings at the library, going through bibliographies, and hunting up copies of PMLA. Sometimes I was able to work on a story of my own when I got back to my apartment. More often, my eyes burned and my stomach was in an uproar from English department coffee, and my instincts for prose were deadened by scholarly waffle. From time to time, I took out a girl in the department, an instructor with a mint-condition Ph.D. from the University of Wisconsin. Her name was Helen Kahan, and our desks, along with 12 others, were next to one another in a communal office. She had read my first book, but it had not impressed her. She was stern about literature, frightened of teaching, careless about her appearance, hopeless about men. Her interests were in Scott's contemporaries of Chaucer and linguistic analysis. At 23, she already had something of the feather impracticality of the old scholar spinster. "My father changed his name from Kayinsky, and I'm just a hard-headed Pole," she said. But it was a classic self-deception. She was hard-headed about Scott's Chaucerians and nothing else. Helen was a large girl with big glasses and loose hair, which always seemed on its way from one style to another. It was hair with unfulfilled intentions. She had decided some time before that what she had to offer the university, the planet, men, was her intelligence. It was the only thing about herself that she trusted. I asked her out for lunch the third time I saw her in the office. She was revising an article, and she nearly jumped out of her chair. I think I was the first man at Berkeley to ask her to lunch. A few days later, I met her in the office after my last class. She was sitting at her desk, staring at her typewriter. Our lunch had been awkward. She had said, comparing the articles she was trying to write with my work, "But I'm trying to describe reality." "I'm leaving," I said. "Why don't you come with me? We'll have a drink somewhere."
"I can't. I hate bars, and I have to work on this," she said. "Oh, look, you could walk me back to my place, okay? It's up the hill. Is that okay for you?"
"That's where I live, too."
"I'm fed up with this anyhow. What are you reading?"
I held up a book.
"Oh, Nathaniel Hawthorne. Your survey course."
"Harvey Lieberman just told me that in 3 weeks I'm giving the main lecture on Hawthorne. I haven't read The House of the Seven Gables since high school."
"Lieberman is a lazy so-and-so."
I was inclined to agree. So far, three of his other assistants had also given lectures for him.
"I'll be all right," I said, "as long as I can figure out some angle to tie it all up and get all the reading done."
At least you don't have tenure to worry about, she said, gesturing toward her typewriter.
No, just eating.
This had the tone of our lunch.
Sorry.
She bowed her head, suffering already, and I touched her shoulder and told her not to take herself so seriously. As we were going down the stairs together, Helen carrying a huge worn briefcase straining with books and essays, me carrying only the House of the Seven Gables, a tall, freckled, blonde girl slipped between us. The first impression I had of Alma Mobley was of a general paleness, a spiritual blurriness suggested by her long, expressionless face and hanging straw-colored hair. Her round eyes were a very pale blue. I felt an odd mixture of attraction and revulsion. In the dim light of the staircase, she looked like an attractive girl who'd spent all her life in a cave. She appeared to be the same ghostly shade of white all over.
"Mr. Wanderley?"
she asked. When I nodded, she muttered her name, but I did not catch it.
"I'm a graduate student in English," she said. "I wondered if you'd mind if I came to your lecture on Hawthorne. I saw your name posted on Professor Lieberman's schedule in the departmental office."
"No, please come," I said. "But it's just a survey class, you know. It'll probably be a waste of time for you."
"Thank you,"
she said, and abruptly continued on up the stairs.
"How did she know who I was?" I whispered to Helen, concealing my pleasure in what I thought was my heretofore invisible celebrity. Helen tapped the book in my hand. She lived only 3 blocks from my own apartment. Hers was a random collection of rooms at the top of an old house, and she shared it with 2 other girls. The rooms seemed arbitrarily placed, and so did the things in them. The apartment looked as if no one had ever considered where bookcases and chairs and tables ought to go. Where delivery men put them, they stayed. Here, a lamp had been put next to a chair, and there, a table, heaped with books, shoved beneath a window. But everything else was so haphazard that you had to weave around the furniture to reach the hall. The roommates, too, seemed arbitrary. Helen had described them to me on the walk up the hill. One of them, Meredith Polk, was also from Wisconsin, a new instructor in the botany department. She and Helen had met while hunting for a place to live, found they had done graduate work at the same university, and decided to live together. The third girl was a theater graduate student named Hillary Lahardy. Helen said, "Hillary never leaves her room and stays high all day, I think, and she plays rock music most of the night. I put in earplugs. But Meredith is better. She's very intense and a little bit odd, but I think we're friends. She tries to protect me."
"Protect you from what?"
"Vileness."
Both of the roommates were at home when I reached Helen's apartment. As soon as I came in behind Helen, an overweight, black-haired girl in blue jeans and a sweatshirt shot out of the door from the kitchen and glared at me through thick glasses. Meredith Polk. Helen introduced me as a writer in the English department, and Meredith said,
"Jidoo,"
and zipped back into the kitchen. Loud music came from a side bedroom. The spectacled, black-haired girl cannoned out of the kitchen again as soon as Helen had gone in to get me a drink. She wove through the furniture to a camp chair near a wall against which stood what looked like hundreds of cacti and plants and pots. She slotted a cigarette in her mouth and stared at me with an intent suspicion.
"You're not an academic, not on the regular staff?"
This from a first-year instructor. Years from tenure. I said, "I just have a year's appointment. I'm a writer."
"Oh,"
she said, more staring for a moment, then,
"So you're the one who took her to lunch?"
"Yes."
"Ah."
The music boomed through the wall.
Hillary, she said, nodding in the direction of the music. Our roommate.
Doesn't it bother you?
I don't hear it most of the time. Concentration. And it's good for the plants.
Helen came out with a tumbler too full of whiskey, one ice cube floating at the top like a dead goldfish. She carried a cup of tea for herself.
Excuse me, Meredith said, and darted off in the direction of her room.
Oh, it's nice to see a man in this awful place, Helen said. For a moment, all the worry and self-consciousness left her face, and I saw the real intelligence that lay beneath her academic cleverness. She looked vulnerable, but less so than I had thought. We went to bed a week later at my apartment. She was not a virgin, and she was firm about not being in love. In fact, she went about the entire matter of deciding to do it and then doing it with the brisk precision she brought to the Scots Chaucerians.
You'll never fall in love with me, she said, and I don't expect you to. That's fine.
She spent two nights at my apartment that time. We went to the library together in the evenings, vanishing into our separate carols, as if there were no emotion at all between us. The only actual sign I had that this was not so came one evening a week later when I found Meredith Polk outside my door when I came home. She was still wearing the jeans and sweatshirt.
You shit!
She hissed at me, and I quickly opened the door and got her inside.
You cold-hearted bastard! She said. You're going to wreck her chances for tenure. And you're breaking her heart. You treat her like a whore. She's much too good for you. You don't even have the same values. Helen's committed to scholarship. It's the most important thing in her life. I understand that, but I don't think you do. I don't think you're committed to anything but your sex life.
One thing at a time, I said. How can I possibly be wrecking her chances for tenure? Let's just take that one first.
This is her first semester here. They watch us, you know. How do you think it looks if a new instructor jumps in the sack with the first guy who comes along?
This is Berkeley. I don't think anyone notices or cares.
You pig. You don't notice or care. You don't notice anything or care about anything. That's the truth. Do you love her?
Get out, I said. I was losing my temper. She looked like an angry frog croaking at me, defining her territory. Helen herself arrived 3 hours later, looking pale and bruised. She would not discuss Meredith Polk's astounding accusations, but she said she had talked to her the night before.
Meredith is very protective, she said. She must have been to you. I'm sorry, Don.
Then she began to cry.
No, don't rub my back like that. Don't. It's just foolish. It's only that I haven't been able to work the past few nights. I guess I've been unhappy whenever I haven't been with you.
She looked up at me, stricken.
I shouldn't have said that. But you don't love me, do you? You couldn't, could you?
There's no answer to that. Let me get you a cup of tea. She was lying on the bed in my little apartment, curled up like a fetus.
I feel so guilty.
I came back with her tea.
I wish we could take a trip together, she said. I wish we could go to Scotland together. I've spent all these years reading about Scotland, and I've never been there.
Her eyes were brimming behind the big glasses.
Oh, I'm a horrible mess. I knew I should never have come out here. I was happy in Madison. I should never have come to California.
You belong here more than I do.
No,
she said, and rolled over to hide her face.
You can go anywhere and fit in. I've never been anything but a working-class drudge.
What's the last really good book you read? I asked.
She rolled back over to face me, curiosity defeating the misery and embarrassment on her face. Squinting, she considered it for a moment.
"The Rhetoric of Irony by Wayne Booth. I just reread it."
"You belong at Berkeley," I said.
"I belong in a zoo."
It was an apology for everything, for Meredith Polk as much as for her own feelings, but I knew that if we went on, I could only hurt her more. She was right. It was not possible that I could ever love her. Afterward, I thought that my Berkeley life had settled into a pattern to which the rest of my life would adhere. It was, except for my work, essentially empty. But wasn't it better to continue seeing Helen than to wound her by insisting on a break? In the work-bound world I saw as mine, expedience was a synonym for kindness. When we parted, between us was the understanding that we would not meet for a day or two, but that all would continue as before. But a week later, the conventional period of my life came to an end. After it, I saw Helen Kayon only twice. 2. I had found the hook for the Hawthorne lecture. It was in an essay by R.P. Blackmer. "When every possibility is taken away, then we have sinned." The idea seemed to radiate throughout Hawthorne's work, and I could connect the novels and stories by this black Christianity, by the impulse in them for nightmare, by what was almost their desire for nightmare. For to imagine a nightmare is to put it at one remove. And I found a statement by Hawthorne which helped to explain his method. "I have sometimes produced a singular and not unpleasing effect, so far as my own mind was concerned, by imagining a train of incidents in which the spiritual mechanism of the fairy legend should be combined with the characters and manners of everyday life. When I had the ideas which would structure the lecture, the details fell onto the pages of my notebook. This work and my writing students kept me fully occupied for the 5 days before the lecture. Helen and I met fleetingly, and I promised her that we would get away for a weekend when my immediate work was done. My brother David owned a cottage in Still Valley, outside Mendocino, and he'd told me to use it whenever I wanted to get away from Berkeley. This was typical of David's thoughtfulness, but a kind of perversity had kept me from using the house. I did not want to have to be grateful to David. After the lecture, I would take Helen to Still Valley and kill 2 scruples at once. On the morning of the lecture, I reread D.H. Lawrence's chapter about Hawthorne and saw these lines. "And the first thing she does is seduce him. And the first thing he does is to be seduced. And the second thing they do is to hug their sin in secret and gloat over it and try to understand, which is the myth of New England." That was what I had been looking for all along. I put down my cup of coffee and started to restructure my remarks. Lawrence's insight extended my own. I could see all the books in a new way. I discarded paragraphs and wrote in new ones between the crossed-out lines. I forgot to call Helen, as I had promised to do. In the end, I used my notes very sparingly. Once, straining for a metaphor, I leaned on the lectern and saw Helen and Meredith Polk seated together in one of the last rows, up at the top of the theater. Meredith Polk was frowning, suspicious as a Berkeley cop. When scientists hear the kinds of things that go on in literature classrooms, they often begin to look that way. Helen merely looked interested, and I was grateful that she had come. When it was over, Professor Lieberman came up from his aisle seat to tell me that he had enjoyed my remarks very much,
and would I consider taking his Stephen Crane lecture in 2 months' time? He was due at a conference in Iowa that week, and since I had done such an exemplary job, especially considering that I was not an academic, in short, he might find it possible to extend my appointment to a second year. I was stunned as much by the bribe as by his arrogance. Lieberman, still young, was a famous man, not so much a scholar in Helen's sense as a critic, a generalizer, a sub-Edmund Wilson. I did not respect his books, but I expected more of him. The students were filing up toward the exits, a solid mass of T-shirts and denim. Then I saw a face lifted expectantly toward me, a slim body clothed not in denim, but in a white dress. Lieberman was suddenly an interference, an obstacle, and I agreed to give the Crane lecture to get rid of him. "Very good, Donald," he said, and disappeared. As quickly as that. One moment the seersuckered young professor was before me, and the next I was looking into the face of the girl in the white dress. It was the graduate student who had stopped Helen and me on the stairs. She looked completely different, healthier, with a light golden layer of tan on her face and arms. The straight blonde hair glowed. So did her pale eyes. In them, I saw a kaleidoscope of shattered lights and colors. Her mouth was bracketed by two faint lines of irony. She was ravishing, one of the most beautiful girls I'd ever seen. No small statement, for Berkeley was so populated by beauties that you saw two new ones every time you looked up from your desk. But the girl before me had none of the gaucheness or assertive, testing vulgarity of the usual undergraduate knockout. She simply looked right, perfectly at home in herself. Helen Kayon didn't have a chance. "That was good," she said, and the faint lines beside her mouth twitched as if at a private joke. "I'm happy I came after all." For the first time, I heard the southern accent, that sunny drawl, that lilt. "So am I," I said. "Thank you for the compliment."
"Do you want to relish it in private?"
"Is that an invitation?" And then I saw that I was being too quick, too self-consciously flattered and one-dimensional.
"A what? No, I'm not aware that it was."
Her mouth moved. What an idea! I looked up to the top of the lecture theater. Helen and Meredith Polk were already in the aisle, going toward the door. Helen must have begun to move as soon as she'd seen me look at the blonde. If she knew me as well as she had said she did, she had known just what I was thinking. Helen went through the exit door without turning around, but Meredith Polk tried to assassinate me with a glance.
"Are you waiting for someone?" the girl said.
"No, it's nothing important," I said. "Would you join me for lunch? I never did have lunch, and I'm starving." I was behaving, I knew, with appalling selfishness. But I also knew that the girl before me was already more important to me than Helen Kayon, and by letting Helen go at once, by being the bastard Meredith Polk said I was eliminating weeks, perhaps months, of painful scenes. I had not lied to Helen. She had always known that our relationship was fragile. The girl walking beside me across the campus lived in perfect consonance with her femininity. Even then, moments after I had first seen her in good light, she seemed ageless, even timeless, beautiful in a nearly hieratic and mythic way. Helen's separation from herself had kept her from gracefulness, and she was blatantly a person of my own blink of history. My first impression of Alma Mobley was that she could have moved with that easy grace over an Italian piazza in the 16th century, or in the 20s, more to the point, could have earned an appreciative glance from Scott Fitzgerald flying past the Plaza Hotel on her devastating legs. Set down like that, it sounds absurd. Obviously, I had noticed her legs. I had a sense of her body. But images of Italian piazzas and Fitzgerald at the Plaza are more than unlikely metaphors for carnality. It was as though every cell of her possessed ease. Nothing less typical of the usual Berkeley graduate student in English can be imagined. The gracefulness went so deep in her that it seemed, even then, to mark an intense passivity. Of course, I am condensing 6 months' impressions into a single moment, but my justification is that the seeds of the impression were present as we left the campus to go to a restaurant. Her going with me so willingly, with such unconcern that it resounded with unspoken judgments, did contain a whiff of the passive, the ironic, tactful passivity of the beautiful, of those whose beauty has sealed them off inside it like a princess in a tower. I steered her toward a restaurant I had heard Lieberman mention. It was too expensive for most students, too expensive for me. But the ceremony of luxurious dining suited both her and my sense of celebration. I knew immediately that it was she I wanted to take to David's house in Still Valley. Her name, I learned, was Alma Mobley, and she had been born in New Orleans. I gathered more from her manner than from anything explicitly stated that her parents had been well off. Her father had been a painter, and long stretches of her childhood had been spent in Europe. Speaking of her parents, she used the past tense, and I gathered that they had died some time ago. That, too, fit her manner, her air of disconnection from all but herself. Like Helen, she had been a student in the Midwest. She had gone to the University of Chicago. This seemed next to impossible. Alma in Chicago, that rough, knockabout city, and had been accepted as a PhD student at Berkeley. From what she said, I understood that she was just drifting through the academic life, that she had none of Helen's profound commitment to it. She was a graduate student because she had a talent for the mechanics of literary work and was bright. It was better than anything else she could think of doing. And she was in California because she had not liked the Chicago climate. Again, and overwhelmingly, I had the sense of the irrelevance to her of most of the furniture of her life, of her passive self-sufficiency. I had no doubt that she was bright enough to finish her thesis, Virginia Woolf, and then with luck to get a teaching job at one of the little colleges up and down the coast. Then, suddenly and shockingly, she lifting a spoonful of mint-green avocado to her mouth, I had another vision of her. I saw her as a whore, a 1910 Storyville prostitute, her hair exotically twisted, her dancer's legs drawn up. Her naked body was very clear for a moment. Another image of professional detachment, I supposed, but that did not explain the force of the vision. I had been sexually moved by it. She was talking about books, talking not as Helen did, but in a general reader way, and I looked across the table and I knew that I wanted to be the man who mattered to her. I wanted to grab that passivity and shake it and make her truly see me. "Don't you have a boyfriend?" I asked her. She shook her head. "So you're not in love?"
"No."
And she gave a minute smile at the obviousness of the question.
"There was a man in Chicago, but that's finished."
I pounced on the noun. "One of your professors?"
"One of my associate professors."
Another smile. Were you in love with him? Was he married? She looked at me gravely for a moment.
No. It wasn't like what you're thinking. He wasn't married, and I wasn't in love with him.
Even then, I recognized that she would find it very easy to lie. This did not repulse me. Instead, it was a proof of how lightly her life had touched her, and was a part of all that I already wanted to change in her.
He was in love with you, I said. Was that why you wanted to leave Chicago?
No, it was already over by then. Alan didn't have anything to do with it. He made a fool of himself, that's all.
Alan?
Alan McKechnie. He was very sweet.
A very sweet fool.
Are you determined to know about this? She asked, with her characteristic trick of adding a soft, almost invisible irony which denied the question any importance.
No, just a little curious.
Well,
her eyes, full of that shattered light, met mine.
It's not much of a story. He became infatuated. I was in a tutorial with him. There were only four of us, three boys and myself. The tutorial met twice a week. I could tell he was getting interested in me, but he was a very shy man. He was very inexperienced with women.
Again that soft, lobbing deflection in her voice and eyes.
He took me out a few times. He didn't want us to be seen, so we had to go places not in Hyde Park.
Where did you go?
Hotel bars, places like that, around the loop. I think it was the first time he'd ever done anything like that with a student, and it made him nervous. I don't think he'd had much fun in his life. Eventually, I became too much for him. I realized that I didn't want him in the way he wanted me. I know what you're going to ask next, so I'll answer it. Yes, we slept together. For a while. It wasn't much good. Alan was not very physical. I began to think that what he really wanted to do was to go to bed with a boy. But of course he was too whatever to do that. He couldn't.
How long did it last?
A year.
She finished her meal and dropped her napkin beside the plate.
I don't know why we're talking about this.
What do you really like?
She pretended to consider it seriously.
Let's see. Really like. Summer. Movies. English novels. Waking up at 6 and seeing very early morning out of the window. Everything is so empty and pure. Lemon tea. What else? Paris. And Nice. I really do like Nice. When I was a little girl, we went there 4 or 5 summers in a row. And I like very good meals, like this one.
It doesn't sound like the academic life is the one for you, I said. It was as though she had told me everything and nothing.
It doesn't, does it?
She laughed, as at something of no importance.
I suppose what I need is a great love.
And there she was again, the princess locked in the tower of her own self-regard.
Let's go to a movie tomorrow night, I said, and she agreed.
The next day I persuaded Rex Leslie, whose office was down the hall from mine, to exchange desks with me. The art cinema was showing Renoir's La Grande Illusion, which Alma had never seen. Afterward, we went to a coffee shop, a place packed with students, and bits of conversation from adjoining tables filtered through into our own. For a moment after we sat down, I experienced a flash of guilty fear, and recognized a second later that I was afraid of seeing Helen Kayon. But it was not her sort of place. And anyhow, at this hour, Helen usually was still at the library. I felt a moment of intense gratitude that I was not there too, grinding away at a discipline that was not only my own, but merely a condition of employment.
"What a beautiful movie," she said. "I still feel like I'm in it."
"You feel movies very deeply, then?"
"Of course."
She looked at me, puzzled. "And literature?"
"Of course."
She looked at me again.
"Well, I don't know. I enjoy it."
A bearded boy in a lumberjack shirt near us said in a carrying voice,
"Winner is naive, and so is his magazine. I'll start buying it again when I see a picture of Jerry Brown on the cover."
His friend said,
"Winner is Jerry Brown."
"Berkeley," I said.
"Who is Winner?"
"I'm surprised you don't know. Jan Winner?"
"Who is he?"
"He was the Berkeley student who founded Rolling Stone."
"Is that a magazine?"
"You're full of surprises," I said. "You mean you've never heard of it?"
"I'm not interested in most magazines. I never look at them." "What kind of magazine is it? Is it named after that band?"
I nodded. At least she had heard of them. "What kind of music do you like?"
"I'm not very interested in music."
"Let's try some other names. Do you know who Tom Seaver is?"
"No."
"Have you ever heard of Willie Mays?"
"Didn't he used to be an athlete? I'm also not very interested in sports."
"It shows." She giggled. "You're getting even more intriguing. How about Barbara Streisand?" She pouted, charmingly, self-parodyingly.
"Of course."
"John Ford?" "No." "Arthur Fonzarelli?" "No." "Grace Bumbry?" "No." "Desi Arnaz?" "No." "Johnny Carson?" "No." "Andre Previn?" "No." "John Dean?" "No."
"Don't ask me any more, or I'll start saying yes to everything," she said.
"What do you do?" I asked. "Are you sure you live in this country?"
"Let me try you. Have you heard of Anthony Powell, or Jean Reese, or Ivy Compton Burnett, or Elizabeth Jane Howard, or Paul Scott, or Margaret Drabble, or..."
"They're English novelists, and I've heard of all of them," I said. "But I take your point. You're really not interested in the things you're not really interested in."
"Exactly."
"You never even read newspapers," I said.
"No. And I never watch television," she smiled. "Do you think I should be stood against a wall and shot?"
"I'm just interested in who your friends are."
"Do you? Well, you are a friend of mine, aren't you?"
Over it, and over our entire conversation, was that veneer of disinterested irony. I wondered for a moment if she were actually entirely human. Her nearly complete ignorance of popular culture demonstrated more than any assertion how little she cared what people thought of her. What I had thought of as her integrity was more complete than I could have imagined. Maybe a sixth of the graduate students in California had never heard of an athlete like Seaver, but who in America could have avoided hearing of the Fonz? "But you do have other friends. You just met me."
"I do, yes."
"In the English department?" It was not impossible. For all I knew of my temporary colleagues, there might have been an extensive cell of Virginia Woolf fanciers who never looked at the newspapers. In them, however, this remoteness from their surroundings would have been an affectation. Of Alma, the reverse would have been true.
"No, I don't know many people there. I know some people who are interested in the occult."